From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. Today we'll learn about an omnibus act in Congress, addressing some of the root causes of maternal mortality. Then we'll tell you about Milwaukee's neighborhood traffic management program.
Most people think of it as a speed hump program. We're trying to get both the department and the public to think about more than just speed humps, and also starting to talk about how we could structure it so that other traffic calming improvements could be paid for.
Plus, we'll explore what makes a bad movie good in a conversation all about trash cinema.
There is so much significance in trash that we've been kind of unwilling to recognize for so long because we're so obsessed with markers of quality.
All of that is coming up on Lake Effect. But first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers, and thank you so much for joining us. Maternal mortality is predicted to skyrocket in states throughout the U.S. as restrictions on abortion are threatening the lives of pregnant people. Health complications that were once treated with abortions, including lethal fetal anomalies, severe preeclampsia, or kidney disease, can no longer receive this care in many states until a person's health worsens to the point where they're in the process of dying. Many don't live past that point. A group of bills circulating in the U.S. Congress are addressing some of the root causes of maternal mortality in an effort to stem the rising tide of death. Wisconsin U.S. Senator Tammy Baldwin is one of the backers of what's being called the Momnibus Act, and she joins me now to talk about it. Senator Baldwin, thank you so much for being here on Lake Effect.
It is my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So you're calling this a Momnibus Act. There is a lot of stuff that is inside of this. How do these different bills address the causes of maternal deaths?
Yeah, so first, let's just start with the fact that there is a disproportionate number of women of color, especially Black women, who are dying from pregnancy. It's happening at tragically high rates in Wisconsin and across the country. And we really have to confront this crisis head on and give moms and babies the healthcare they need. And so the Momnibus is actually composed of a number of initiatives that have been offered to deal with different aspects of the Black maternal health crisis, from investing in maternal mental health to ensuring that there is the needed healthcare workforce and the bottom line is that we know that healthier pregnancies will lead to healthier babies.
So it seems like these bills are, yes, of course, focusing on Black maternal health, but maternal health more generally.
Yes.
I think one of the big elephants in the room here is, of course, abortion access. As you know, Wisconsin now has one of the most restrictive abortion bans in the nation. And we know this risks the lives of pregnant people throughout the state. I do wonder, as I look at these bills, how much progress can we make on maternal mortality without addressing abortion access? How do we wrap around services to ensure that people are, you know, living?
Right. Well, we have to keep on fighting on both fronts. There's just no question about that. And, I share a heightened concern about not only the fact that Wisconsin has the nation's oldest and one of the, you know, basically a criminal ban on abortion care in the state of Wisconsin, and it's putting mothers' lives at risk. But it also is having an impact on the workforce. People who are practicing in obstetrics and gynecology and have these potential criminal penalties hovering over them, many are moving their practices to other states. So we have to both fight to regain the right to full and comprehensive reproductive health care, including abortion care. At the same time, we fight this battle to make sure that every pregnancy is a healthy one, and that we are fighting against the disproportionate maternal mortality experienced by women of color, especially Black women.
As you mentioned, something we're seeing here in Wisconsin and in a lot of states that have really aggressive abortion bans is the closure of obstetrics units. Now, some of the closures here have not been due to the abortion ban, but rather management issues at hospitals. But we are seeing an issue with both rural OBGYNs leaving the state and even in urban areas. How does this bill address specifically our health care needs inside of the system?
Yeah. Well, let me deal with various aspects of that question in turn. I look back to a piece of legislation, bipartisan legislation, that I offered several years ago that helps us understand where these healthcare provider shortages are, and then provides loan forgiveness programs for health professionals who will go and serve in underserved areas. There are counties in Wisconsin, by way of example, where really to get the maternity care that you need, you would have to drive hours. And so having both clinical workforce, but also support through professionals like doulas, by way of example, midwives, helping make that happen in underserved areas has been a priority, and we need to build upon that work and that measure that was passed a few years back. The Perinatal Workforce Act, which I sponsor in the Senate along with Congresswoman Gwen Moore in the House leading on this bill, is particularly focused on building and diversifying the healthcare workforce. And that diversifying aspect is particularly important, that from pregnancy to postpartum care, we need to make sure that new moms have the support they need to set themselves and their families and their babies up for success. And providing resources to diversify and grow this critical workforce really helps us achieve that goal.
One of the issues that really stuck out to me that these bills deal with is this idea of supporting mothers with mental health or substance abuse disorders. Especially in a state like Wisconsin, there are a lot of concerns right now that with abortion bans, women who experience these other health conditions like mental health issues or substance abuse disorders can now be criminalized for endangering the life of another person. We know that, of course, women of color, especially Black women in Wisconsin, are disproportionately criminalized for a variety of behaviors. People are becoming more hesitant to seek medical attention for these issues for that reason. Does this bill deal with that hesitancy in how it's supporting women seeking this kind of help?
Yes. Yeah, so the particularly the Momnibus, which is, as I indicated, a collection of a number of different initiatives. Specifically, there are reforms and measures to support moms with maternal mental health conditions and substance use disorders, also to improve maternal health care and support for incarcerated moms. You talked about the criminalization that occurs, but what resources are there for those who are pregnant and incarcerated? There's ways for those in rural areas, rural underserved areas, to improve digital tools, if you will, to get that mental health care and other care in more remote areas or underserved areas. Basically, the Momnibus bill takes an all hands on deck approach to trying to reduce maternal mortality, and is especially focused on moms of color, Black and Brown and Indigenous women, all of whom have higher incidences of maternal mortality.
Does it look at all at that kind of fear of criminalization? We are seeing women in some states being arrested, being charged with, certainly they can be charged with murder in a variety of states for endangering the life of a fetus or, you know, another person in this case, in, as some states define it. Do we see that being dealt with when we're talking about the ways we're supporting women through substance abuse, through mental health conditions, or is that something that is really dealt with more at the state level?
Yeah, I would say that the Momnibus was presented the first time before the Dobbs decision came out last summer. Obviously, the Dobbs decision, the U.S. Supreme Court overturned nearly 50 years of precedent in overturning Roe versus Wade. And what happened at that moment was that the issue of abortion care became determined in each state by the laws of the state. And as we discussed earlier, a state like Wisconsin has a measure that was passed by the Wisconsin legislature in 1849. That is, you know, is a near total criminal abortion ban, with only an exception to save the life of the mother. And so we're seeing across the country these issues so complicated by the fact that every state has a different set of laws. A lot of states are re-examining their laws, some for the better, some for the worse, in my opinion, in the wake of the U.S. Supreme Court decision in Dobbs. And it makes the work of preventing bad maternal outcomes so much more difficult, to have this patchwork quilt and to have states like Wisconsin, where the full range of reproductive health care is not available to all women. I will note that in a different piece of legislation, the Women's Health Protection Act, which I lead in the United States Senate, that would at the national level return to make Roe versus Wade the law of the land again. And it would take the extra step of making sure that states didn't interfere with the rights articulated in Roe versus Wade, as we've seen so many, including Wisconsin, do. That bill is on a separate track. But I believe that ultimately we have to pass both.
You're listening to Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers, and I'm speaking right now with U.S. Senator Tammy Baldwin about the Momnibus Act currently circulating in Congress. So right now, maybe the biggest thing happening in Congress is the discussion over the debt ceiling. And it does seem like healthcare may be at the heart of this fight as well. As Representative McCarthy is saying, Medicaid work requirements are potentially a red line for Republicans. Do you see a path forward right now?
I do believe we will resolve. I am hopeful that we will be able to avoid default, particularly because almost now all the folks in leadership have said we have to take default off the table. But I will fight furiously to make sure that as we turn to the issue of future spending, that we do not see through the type of cuts that the House Republicans were contemplating in the bill they passed a couple weeks back, which would slash a wide range of health programs that help moms, children, families, you know, whether that's nutritional support, like the Women, Infants, Children program that provides nutrition and support for postpartum, for women and babies postpartum. And likewise, fighting the type of cuts and policy changes in Medicaid that would lead to injuring the health of the very people who and children who Medicaid serves.
All right, we will see what the future holds. Senator Baldwin, thank you so much for taking the time out to speak with me this morning.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Wisconsin U.S. Senator Tammy Baldwin is one of the backers of the Momnibus Act, a group of bills that address maternal mortality in the U.S. You can hear our full conversation at WUWM.com.
From Milwaukee's NPR, this is Capital Notes. We break down the big political news affecting Wisconsin. I'm Ayan Silver, speaking with J.R. Ross, editor of WisPolitics.com. He provides a roundup of the Wisconsin developments you need to know. Here's our latest conversation. Hi, J.R., nice to chat with you again.
Hey, thanks for having me.
I'd like to talk about state aid to local governments again, called shared revenue. To get people up to speed again, it's money to localities like the city of Milwaukee, Milwaukee County. It's been frozen for about 30 years, and places like Milwaukee are facing dire financial straits and cuts to services if something isn't done. In Milwaukee, it's because of approaching pension payments and increasing costs. Republicans and Democrats both agree action is necessary and have put forth plans. What's the latest version of the GOP shared revenue bill?
Well, we have a bill that passed the Assembly last week that makes some tweaks to the original proposal. It's still all centered around the idea of taking one penny of the state's 5-cent sales tax and putting it into a new fund that would basically cover a host of state aids and local governments. So that's the foundation for it. Remember, the original bill that Republicans proposed included a number of strings on how the money could be used, number of kind of restrictions on Milwaukee in particular, about things like how the streetcar is funded. A lot of those things remain. They tweaked them a little bit. So, for example, the original bill, restrictions about how long a local public health official could shut down businesses to deal with a outbreak or a pandemic, that went from being 14 days to 30 before you need to get permission from elected officials to extend it. So there's some tweaks like that. The big hang-up right now is whether to require Milwaukee County and the city to go to referendum to approve a new sales tax. So you kind of mentioned the city and county's pension problems before. The Republican approach would allow the county to add 0.375% to its current sales tax, allow the city to impose a new 2% sales tax, and basically that money would be dedicated toward the pension obligations. There's a fiscal cliff facing the city and county starting, I think, in 2025, that if they don't find more money, those pension obligations are going to eat up so much of their budget, they're going to be in real bad shape. So that sales tax money would go toward retiring the pension obligation. Then to fix the system kind of permanently, all new hires, the city and county would go in the state system. Milwaukee County is the only ones in the state that have a separate retirement system from the state. So that would basically put all those new hires in there. The sales taxes would continue until, I think, 30 years or the pension obligations are met, whichever happens first, and then go away. So that's kind of the foundation. And right now the question is that referendum component. Because if you talk to local officials in Milwaukee, they will tell you that they have real concerns on whether the referendum would pass, because The governor, for example, his plan had a 1% sales tax for Milwaukee for the city and county to share. And that included a referendum component. But there was no restriction on how that money could be used. Now you're telling Milwaukee voters, look, we want you to consider raising your taxes, not for things you like about city services, but for retiring pension obligations that were built up by mismanagement by past leaders over years. That's a tough sell. So the question is, will they go to a referendum or allow this common council and county board to approve those sales taxes instead?
Senate Majority Leader Devin Lemahieu, who's a Republican, said last week that the bill to increase state aid to local governments will likely not have that provision, calling for Milwaukee to get approval from voters before raising the sales taxes. But Assembly Speaker Robin Voss, who's also a Republican and came up with a Republican proposal on the Assembly, said that that would kill the bill and that the Assembly wouldn't take up a new bill. What can you tell us about that?
Well, yeah, look at Robin Voss's comments closely. He said it could kill the bill, and he said that they would non-concur. So first, you know, could's different than would, right? So he's got to pay attention to how these guys talk. He's trying to lay down a marker and really kind of spur the Senate Republican caucus to act. Senate Republicans have been kind of chomping at the bit to get this thing done for a while. They feel like the Senate's taking its time. So it may be a little bit of drama just to kind of spur action. The second thing is, there's a process in the legislature where you have to have the same bill pass in the same form before it go to the governor. If one house passes a different version than the other, they send it back to their house to look at. If they don't like the changes, they do a process called a non-concurrence vote, which basically says, we don't like what you did to it, we're not going to agree to it. That doesn't kill the bill. There are other options to kind of move forward. For example, hasn't happened in quite a while around this place, but you go to a conference committee, which is basically a committee that's made up of appointments from each house to work out a deal. Then that deal goes to each house for an up or down vote. So that's an option. You could have both houses in session the same day and pass a bill back and forth and keep changing until you're happy. I mean, there are all kinds of ways to keep this thing going, but Republicans are pushing up against deadline. They want the shared revenue bill done because they want to know how it fits with the budget. Remember, it's not just about what Lemahieu and Voss want. Governor Evers is also part of this conversation. He has made clear he's not happy about the referendum component. That's like the strings on Milwaukee County and city. He wants a clean bill. He's not going to get a clean bill. There's no Republicans are going to approve this kind of money for local governments, and especially for Milwaukee County and the city, without some kind of guardrails of how it's spent. They want Milwaukee to dedicate more money toward police, law enforcement, fire protection, those kinds of things. They are basically saying, okay, we'll help you, but in exchange, you have to do this, this, and this. So, you know, what gets the governor happy? That's a big question. Is he going to be on board with these things? And with the amendment that was approved by the Assembly, he said, I'm not signed on to this. I'm not there. So we've got a ways to go before the thing is all said and done.
What are the key sticking points for Republicans and for Governor Evers, like the non-negotiables?
Well, so that's the interesting thing. The referendum component for a lot of Republicans is non-negotiable. Their core value is they don't want to raise taxes, period. And if you are going to raise taxes, you should give people a say, right? You should go to referendum. So their thinking is, if we're not going to require referendum, you're going to have to give on something else. So the question becomes, what would Evers have to give up in order to get the referendum component thrown out? You know, it could be a promise to do something in the budget on taxes or on school choice or things that the governor's not real happy about doing. But that's a real possibility to grease the skids for a deal. And the budget is really kind of an important part of this play as well. Republicans want the shared revenue bill done, know that Evers is on board, so they kind of build their budget around it. Evers wants to know, okay, if we're going to give X number of dollars to local governments in this shared revenue bill, I also want to know in the budget, are you going to keep current funding levels for transit aids, for example, which is money to local governments to help pay for, you know, buses and those kinds of things. Because if you're going to increase shared revenue, but then cut transit aids, the governor's unhappy. So these bills kind of work in kind of together in a way, and there's a pressure to get this thing done to know how it's going to work with the budget. But also the governor wants to know, okay, I want some assurances that if I sign your version of the bill, you're not going to go and screw around with these other things once I get the budget sent to me.
What does it mean when Assembly Speaker Voss says that they're done negotiating, but Governor Evers says the opposite?
Well, sometimes in politics, there's negotiation. There's public stances to kind of spur action. So people don't doubt that Robin Voss has some red lines about what he wants in that bill. So for example, let's talk about the referendum component, okay? If you take that out, some people argue you should be able to allow the Common Council and County Board to approve via vote the sales tax increases. The Republicans say, okay, well, if we go that system, we should require a unanimous vote. Well, that is a tough thing to get in anybody. And there are people in Milwaukee who say, look, we don't know the County Board and Common Council would vote unanimously for those sales tax increases. They don't like the restrictions, some people, on how Milwaukee spends its money. There is a provision in this bill that would basically end diversity, equity, inclusion efforts by the city and county. They're not thrilled with that either. So how do you get to a unanimous vote with things that people don't like? Same time, if you allow a majority vote, Republicans kind of go, look, we're not thrilled with the idea of giving Milwaukee the tools financially to get out of the quandary that they're in, because let's be honest, there are not any great options from the state, at least, to Milwaukee if this doesn't work out. And Milwaukee has no good option either other than like deep, deep cuts to services and staff. If we're going to give these tools, we want to see something in return. And if you're going to split on this proposal with all the work that we've done, Republicans will say, it's like you're kind of basically kicking us in the shins. We don't appreciate that kind of optic of you guys barely saying yes. So there is a real question of what's the methodology going to be to approve this and what the standard is going to be to get it done.
Well, you've mentioned some of the strings that Assembly Republicans wanted to put on this money. That includes controlling in some ways what the city spends on police. They want police officers back in Milwaukee public schools. They want to gut the city's civilian-controlled police and fire oversight commission. Any idea whether these will be backed by the Senate, which is expected to take it up in early June?
Well, there are definitely some things that they were going to agree to. The question is which ones? And again, what's Evers' bottom line? How much can he take? And, for Republicans are also knowing, look, the mayor and county executive are part of these discussions that produce these bills, right? So they knew what was in there. And if you listen to the county executive and the mayor, they're not thrilled about the provisions in there about restricting local control, but their entire focus has been on that sales tax money and the question of the referendum. That's what you hear them talk about the most, because they are fearful if the referendum were to fail, they'd have no plan B. So I don't know if I want to say that the restrictions are palatable, but they can seem like they can kind of live with them right now with what's been proposed.
How else, in addition to public hearings, how can local governments, and actually in particular local residents, how can they impact the process? Is that even part of the equation?
Sure. I mean, lawmakers react when they get phone calls. If people call them up and express a point of view and they get enough calls, they pay attention to that kind of stuff.
All right, a lot to think about, JR. And as always, thanks for joining me on Capital Notes.
Anytime.
That was WUWM's Matiyan Silver, speaking with J.R. Ross from WIS Politics. You can hear Capital Notes every other Monday on Lake Effect. Coming up, we'll learn some of the ways that trash cinema pushes boundaries that are both distasteful and important. But first, if reckless driving or speeding is a problem in your neighborhood, there's something you can do about it. We'll explain ahead on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. Reckless driving was declared a public health crisis by the city of Milwaukee in 2021. Residents of the city have no doubt seen cars speeding down busy roads and making risky maneuvers. If you live on a street with a lot of traffic and reckless driving, or speeding is a problem where you live, there's actually something you can do about it. It's called the Neighborhood Traffic Management Program, and it offers residents a chance to try and mitigate reckless driving in their own neighborhoods. WUWM Community Engagement Coordinator Rafa Munoz speaks with City Engineer Kevin Muse about the program and how you can take part.
The Neighborhood Traffic Management Program is about 15 years old now, and it was created to give residents an opportunity to request engineering solutions that can calm traffic on their street. So it's really designed for, at least as it currently exists, primarily the residential parts of the city, to address what people see outside their front door as far as speeding or other challenges they might face on their street.
Who can request these measures? Is it just renters? Is it just property owners? Is it anybody?
Yeah, so any resident can request it. If you Google Milwaukee Neighborhood Traffic Management Program, or NTMP, you'll get a link right to the Department of Public Works website.
Are all streets eligible for the traffic measures? Can you talk about that, what that eligibility would look like for this program?
Yeah, and so I do want to clarify for listeners that we're actually in the middle of rethinking some of this program within the department. So the information you'll find on the website is what the program has historically been, which is very much focused on neighborhood streets, local streets, not anything that you would consider to be even a slightly busy street, certainly not a business street or a larger street that we call an arterial that carries major traffic like a Burleigh or something like that. We are reconsidering some of that within the department and trying to figure out how we can meld what we have authority to do from the council into something that can be used on more different types of streets across the city. So yeah, focused on neighborhood streets right now. Most people think of it as a speed hump program. We're trying to get both the department and the public to think about more than just speed humps, and also starting to talk about how we could structure it so that other traffic calming improvements could be paid for by adjacent property owners and other types of streets across the city.
As it stands now, if you're on a bus line, that you probably can't get a safety measure implemented on your street.
Not a speed hump, no. We do have a specific improvement that we tend to use on streets that have bus lines. It's called a speed table. There aren't too many of these in the city yet. A couple were installed, I think, last year on Superior, right near South Shore Park in Bayview. So that's probably the only place people could go experience a speed table if they wanted to in the city. But we're looking at a number of other improvements that do work with a bus line, or you know, do work well near a fire station where you know, with a speed hump, we wouldn't want to slow down a fire truck. And these are the types of improvements that larger vehicles can navigate over with more ease.
I want to jump into the steps for a community member to access the traffic safety measures through the program. Like the first step you kind of mentioned is there's an application, and then there's also signatures that they have to gather. Can you talk to us about that and how they access those forms?
Yep. Yeah. So the easiest way to get a hold of those forms is to go to the website, the Department of Public Works website. As I mentioned earlier, you can just Google Milwaukee Neighborhood Traffic Management Program and it'll come right up. There's a link right there. The form itself has the instructions as to, you know, who to send it to, and you can mail it or scan it in an email, the application to us. You can also just call the city, the general city hotline, 286-CITY, and they can help direct you to the right person to talk to address this issue. So there's, you know, if you don't have internet access or something like that, of course, you can still access this program. So that's kind of the first step in the process is filling out that application. That individual will also be able to talk you through the actual petition process as well, just to make sure that the person who's interested in getting the traffic calming improvement on their street can actually make sure that they're doing it correctly for when we actually receive those forms back.
So my side street is super busy. I want to access the program. I submit the application. I get over 50% of my neighbors to sign on. I submit those forms. What's the next step?
Yeah. So traditionally what we had done after that was done a speed study on a block and consulted with the aldermanic office regarding how interested they thought that the residents would be in this process. With some of the changes that were implemented during the pandemic, the city received American Rescue Plan Act funds. The council directed some of those funds to essentially help reduce the amount that residents have to pay as their share of the traffic calming improvement, which really increased the number of requests we were receiving. So as of right now, we don't do that speed study process or anything like that. We just rely on residents are telling us there's a problem. If more than 50% of the property owners support it at the end of the process, we move forward. And so it's much more simplified than it used to be. Frankly, that speed study step in many cases wasn't necessary anyways, because the streets that are mostly used so far for this program are such low traffic streets that the residents are sometimes the best judge of what's going on there anyways.
After this happens, is there a step before it goes before the Common Council? Is there some sort of cost assessment? What does that look like?
Yeah, so a postcard is sent out to all the property owners on the street that would be impacted by the actual assessment for the improvement. And property owners can, of course, say yes or no. Some choose not to return the postcard as well. And then we provide that information to the Public Works Committee of the Common Council when they have the public hearing and they consider each of these. The final step after that is the actual public hearing, which residents are also welcome to attend and provide comment. You can attend remotely. You can also attend in person and provide feedback. Back during that public hearing, it's usually the first item on the agenda each time a speed hump or any other traffic calming improvement is up. So public hearings can kind of go whichever way the residents want them to go.
Can we talk about how long this will all take? I guess the front end, people submitting the application form and gathering signatures, that's going to depend on how fast they do that. No more speed study. how long does it take for the postcard survey to go out? How long does it take to get to actual committee hearings?
Yeah. So the length of the time in the process actually depends on where we are in the year. Because what we try to do is, like most of our construction, these are constructed over the summer and fall. And so we try to set the process in motion to be ready for essentially a mid to late spring approval process as best we can. So it's less about how long does it take and more like if you request them between, you know, June or even earlier than June of one year, the process to get to the approvals may not happen till the next spring. But it's less about how long does our internal process take and more about how do we set them up so that the construction season can be hit to actually build the improvements.
You guys have a general cost on mm-hmm. the website. Can you talk about how much generally does it cost? I think it's per foot, right? And then yep. talk about that and then who pays for it.
Sure. So the cost for an actual speed hump installation can vary. Depends on what's going on with the contracting industry. And we help bridge some of the gap with our paving funds from the general levy here in the Department of Public Works. But the actual residents are assessed per linear foot of their property frontage. So how wide is your lot is what determines the assessment. Right now, we are still under those reduced assessment rates due to the Rescue Plan Act funds that the council directed to this program. So it's $2 per linear foot. So most lots in the city, I shouldn't say most, a typical lot in the city is often thought to be 40 feet wide. So you're talking about $80. So that would be for a speed hump. Speed tables are more expensive. They're usually constructed. They are, at least in the city, always constructed out of concrete rather than asphalt. So those are more expensive projects. Those can be up to $12 per linear foot on the lot. And again, those are things that are targeted towards streets that are higher use or might have more emergency vehicles, might have a bus line, that sort of thing. We also have traffic circles, which right now are at, I think, $450 per linear foot on the property too. And so right now, those rates are based on a reduced rate. Once the funding from the Rescue Plan Act runs out, we will be talking with the council about changing that rate. Traditionally, our rate, instead of about a third, which is what it is right now, has been a 90% goes on the share of the property owners. And so like as a speed hump, you can generally speaking, think of that as like three times as much as what I just described would be what a speed hump cost would be per linear foot.
If this process moves along and it goes to vote, that gets approved, it's still on this discounted rate. The people that actually get charged for it are the property owners, mm-hmm. not the renters.
Right. That's part of your property tax bill. Yep.
Mm-hmm. Is there anything else you want to add about the program or how people can access it?
Just to note that this is all going to be changing probably before the end of this year. We'll be talking internally, trying to come up with a more robust process again for those improvements that fit in different types of roads across the city rather than just a traditional residential block. And also that, again, the assessment rate could be changing in the near future. And so that's something that, you know, depending on where you are in the process, if you're about to start it right now, don't count on getting the $2 per linear foot because that money may be already consumed by the time you complete the process.
Kevin Muse is the city engineer for Milwaukee. He spoke with WUWM Community Engagement Coordinator Rafa Munoz. Coming up, we're talking trash. Trash cinema, that is, and what makes it so good to watch. That's next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. Have you ever seen a movie so bad it's good? It could just be a bad film, but it could also fit into the genre of trash cinema. Films that may seem trashy on the surface can actually have historical, societal, and cultural significance. In fact, UW-Milwaukee Director of Film Studies Jocelyn Sapaniak-Galise has a whole class dedicated to the genre. She says that trash films push boundaries, embrace shock value, and take on the taboo. To help us understand what makes a movie trash cinema, Sapaniak-Galise joins Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski.
We think about trash typically as being something low budget, something that looks a little amateurish, something that doesn't quite fit into standard mainstream approaches to film. The way that I like to think about trash cinema is that it's a little bit tasteless. So it's something that sort of pushes the boundaries of good taste and makes us question whether we even should be watching it or perhaps most saliently, tell anybody that we watched it at all.
So this is something I was just thinking about. Do you think there's a difference between a B movie and trash cinema?
I do. And part of that, I think, would be about this notion of taste. So when I talk about trash cinema, I'm always actually secretly providing some kind of a philosophical approach to how we think about taste cultures and how taste is not something natural, right? Like the thing that you like, you don't just like it because you like it. You like it because you're educated in a certain way, because you're in a certain class, often a certain race, even a certain gender, a certain nationality, right? So our tastes are shaped by all these different ideologies and experiences that we have. Therefore, a B movie, that's not always really the appropriate parameters of trash, because we can look at something like Showgirls, which is not a B movie. There was actually a significant amount of budget invested in that film, but that is wholeheartedly trash. And it's because it's so much about what are the boundaries of good taste and what are also the boundaries of vulgarity and what's appropriate on screen.
Yeah, so to dive into that a little bit more, as you say, one big component of trash cinema is pushing those boundaries in a distasteful but, you know, important way sometimes as well. So you mentioned vulgarity. What other kind of boundaries are we talking about when it comes to trash cinema?
Vulgarity is a really easy one to point to, right? Like trash cinema is often kind of obscene, right? It's something that that we really don't, you know, we don't want children to watch it. We don't want like anybody who's in like a proper sophisticated kind of art situation to watch it. But it's not just vulgarity, right? You're right. In fact, and this is really important for thinking about trash, because trash operates outside mainstream boundaries and outside respectability, it can also take on certain elements of things that maybe don't seem like they would be entirely socially appropriate at the time, such as issues around queerness. So I think in particular about Ed Wood Jr.'s film, Glen or Glenda, which is released in 1953. And that film, which is, it's really amateurish, it's really low budget, it's really kind of only halfway narrative, but it takes on issues of being trans and the story of Christine Jorgensen, who was a really well-known trans celebrity in the 1950s, and really kind of excavates what that experience is like, which is extremely rare for a film in 1953. So even though that's not a super vulgar movie, even though, you know, it's a low budget, we wouldn't quite put it as a B movie because it's more independent, it operates outside the boundaries of the mainstream and thus can make us think about certain social issues that also exist outside of the mainstream.
One thing that trash cinema does give us that benefits what we may consider, depending on your test, like, you know, the golden standard of cinema, the ones in the canon, the AFI 100 list, all this good stuff, is the role of tropes. And you say without trashy cinema and the tropes that come with it, we wouldn't have these big, successful, well-regarded movies of today. Can you touch upon that?
Sure. What seems trashy at any moment in time is what operates outside the borders of propriety, right? Like what polite society feels okay talking about or okay discussing. And those borders are constantly shifting, right? Mm-hmm. We're constantly pushing against what is socially appropriate to discuss, but also what is stylistically or aesthetically appropriate to show. So I think about something like Herschel Gordon Lewis's films. He made a lot of, he's kind of like the king of splatter films. He made films like Blood Feast in the early 1960s, which is just, I mean, it's just gore. It's just like pure gore. That's it. It's just gore. There's really nothing else going on. It's it's just like a kind of celebration of like how much gore can we throw at the screen. If Herschel Gordon Lewis hadn't done that, we then wouldn't have additional kind of approaches to gory movies that are things like Night of the Living Dead at the end of the 1960s, which at this point is a totally canonical film, right? That is totally canonical. But without Herschel Gordon Lewis's super amateurish, super out there outre approach to filmmaking, that movie really wouldn't have been possible. And of course, people like Quentin Tarantino, he uses so many elements of earlier trashy movies, whether it's movies like Switchblade Sisters, which was a film that he really celebrated, or kind of Hong Kong action movies that exist on the periphery, at least, you know, in the 1990s when Quentin Tarantino was starting up. He takes on a lot of those elements and makes them socially acceptable, turns them actually into Oscar-nominated films. But it's all coming from a celebration and a love of trash.
I'd love to talk about how people see trash film or once saw trash film. You know, so we're ranging from 1950s before up to the 90s today. You know, what's its place in small movie theaters? What was the start of it? Was it like an underground scene? You know, ultimately, can you explain the genesis before today where we can simply search and see if we can stream it somewhere or a random trash thing is uploaded to YouTube in a channel dedicated to trash cinema?
Yeah. Wow. Okay. So that's a huge question because, it's also a question I'm delighted by because I am an exhibition historian and that's my specialization. So I often look at the roots of trash cinema in, about the very early 1930s, although we can really locate it a bit earlier than that too. But the early 1930s is when exploitation cinema becomes something really, really popular. The term exploitation does not actually come from people being exploited or ideas or social mores being exploited. It actually comes, our best guess is that it comes from the kind of advertising that was used for this particular kind of film. And that kind of advertising is also based on a kind of Carnival Barker approach, right? Mm-hmm. Like somebody who's like, come in one and all, see this crazy sideshow and check out what's happening. So exploitation films, they were often positioned as educational films. They were only vaguely educational, but they could use that then to provide all sorts of sort of gory details from everything from like actual footage of childbirth, right, to images of nudity, all under the guise of something educational. An exploitation film would show in theaters that were like on the wrong side of the tracks sometimes, right? Like things that were not quite the fancy downtown theaters, or sometimes exploitation cinema would be shown in a process called four-walling. And that would be renting out some kind of a theatrical space that was really underused, showing your film really quickly, and then kind of taking off after the weekend of showing. So there's a really long legacy of showing trashy, unacceptable, kind of edgy films in places that typical members of polite society would not necessarily go. So then if we skip forward a bit into the 1970s in particular, we get wonderful examples of midnight screenings. And this is, I think, what we all think about now as like this golden era of trash cinema, which is the 1970s. Of course, trashy cinemas would show at drive-ins, but they would also show at theaters like the Elgin, which is one of my very favorite theaters. It was in New York, and the Elgin showed both art house movies and then would show trashy kind of out there movies at midnight. So there's a great tradition of showing trash in moments where you wouldn't see a kind of normal, acceptable film. And that adds to the cachet of seeing a trash movie.
I have to think that another component of that is word of mouth, right? Because people can't come to, you know, these off-the-road theaters unless they know what's happening. And the shock value of the trash cinema is what gets people to talk about it and then continue to show it, right?
You're exactly right, Audrey. That is how the Elgin like understood marketing. They knew that in order to make a midnight movie phenomenon, you could advertise it to a certain amount, but you really had to get people talking about it. You have to get the right cool people talking to the right other cool people. And so it's those kind of like informal networks of distribution that add to a film's cult status and can transform a film from something trashy into something that gets like kind of like trash canonized. Or on the other hand, something arty that gets a little bit trash canonized. So I'm thinking here about something like Eraserhead, which is, you know, now we think of David Lynch as like, whoa, it's David Lynch. He's Mr. Art movie, right? But when Eraserhead came out, people didn't know what to do with it. And they were like really disturbed and upset about it. By showing it at the Elgin and encouraging certain audiences to see it, and then encouraging those audiences to talk to other audiences about it, that film in particular then became the sort of cult phenomenon tied to art phenomenon that it still is today.
So even if some movies are made in bad taste and, of course, push boundaries or sometimes are just really awful, what's the cultural significance and societal significance of this genre?
Oh, wow. There is so much significance in trash that we've been kind of unwilling to recognize for so long because we're so obsessed with markers of quality, right? Mm-hmm. And so much of that has to do with film and mass media in general's excision from the realm of high art for so long, right? I mean, that's not true anymore, but for decades and decades, film struggled to be a part of that kind of like high art hierarchy. Trash manages to disrupt that hierarchy, right? It says that maybe what is high art is not the only thing that's of value. In fact, we can find so many diamonds in this dirt of trash cinema. And when we sift through it, we can discover so much more about what's actually happening in society writ large, what ideologies are really being talked about, what people are afraid of, what people are maybe titillated by. There's all sorts of things that we can sort of parse out when we start really looking at how trash functions. And that is true for a lot of trash cinema. It's why it's so important to look to it and begin to understand it, because we can see so many more elements there that couldn't be addressed in more standard normal film.
Certainly a lot to dig into, but Jocelyn, I want to thank you so much for sharing some of it with me today.
Yeah, thank you.
Jocelyn Sapaniak-Galise is an associate professor of English and film studies and the director of film studies at UW-Milwaukee. She spoke with Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski. And that wraps up today's show. Thank you so much for being here with us. I'm Joy Powers. If you missed any of today's conversations, or if you'd like to take Lake Effect on the go, download our podcast. Search for Lake Effect wherever you get your podcasts to listen to all of our shows on demand. El Rey is celebrating 45 years in Milwaukee. And tomorrow on Lake Effect, we'll look at what makes this family grocer a staple in the community. Plus, we'll hear from local experts on how to make an Italian grinder sandwich after the recipe went viral in Milwaukee. That's all tomorrow at noon, right here on Lake Effect. On listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.